When I first did my first student teaching, of course I was working on my associate degree, and I could teach in Illinois with an associate degree. And I went to Bicknell, and my first grade teacher where I worked under was also the principal. Oh, you're going to start already.
Do you mind?
Oh, no,
I like stories.
Anyway, I had real good instructions, you know. And my first grade teacher that I worked under was the principal at Central School at Bicknell. And after we finished my time, I went up to her house and stayed all day. And her husband was a retired coal miner, and he got dinner for us. And she started from September 1 when we would enter school, and went up till, I think, around Christmas time or maybe a little after. And she said, now today, this is what you do. This is what you add to your teaching curriculum that you have. Then on the next day, this is what you do. And took me all through there and gave me the material. Because when you go in the room, your room is bare. You know, you don't have all the things that accumulate through the years. And she gave me all this material to take me up till, I think, maybe around Christmas time, I had. And her husband got dinner for us, and I stayed all day with her. And then, when I went to get my BS degree, Indiana University wouldn't accept my student teaching on my associate degree. They let me count as elective, but they wouldn't accept it. So then I had to do student teaching again. And Vincennes didn't want any student teaching that year. They didn't know, I don't know why, but they just didn't. But Rosemary Weathers was over at Harrison School, and she had 30 first graders. And I had taught for 5 years, so they let me come in and do my student teaching under Rosemary. Really, we did team teaching because, see, I'd had experience. And then Rosemary was a head teacher, of course, and we taught together then to get her children up to where they ought to be when school was out. And that was, you know, and then another thing on my degree, in Indiana, you know, you have to have your master's in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That just came out, you know, when I started doing all this. So I thought, well, I'll be real smart. And I was doing my BS at Indiana University, and I went to Indiana University to work on my master's while I was still doing my BS. And somebody said, you can't do that. Well, I was doing it, and I don't know how many hours, probably 12. And so I went to my counselor, IU, and told him what I had done and why I did it. And they let me count all my work as electives instead of required. So on my BS degree, I've got improving the teaching of social studies instead of teaching social studies. See, I got the head thing on my thing, but it all worked out. So anyway, that's the way it was. But you said you had some questions. I was going to look at them before we started.
Yeah, let's do that. Let me stop this.
Now, the reason I became a teacher, my husband was a coal miner, and he lost his job and didn't have a high school education. And I had been cleaning houses and things like that. Well, there was a job opened up out at Hillcrest TB Hospital that used to be what it is now. And so I went out to interview for that job, and a lady was ahead of me. And she got the job, of course, but while I was waiting for her to be interviewed, I picked up Time magazine, and it said that if you would become a teacher and teach in inner city schools, the government would pay for your education. And of course, we didn't have any money, and that was a good thing. So I came to Vincennes University, and instead of going to the dean of students like I should have talked to him, I went to the president of the college and talked to him, and asked him that at 40 years old, was I too old to come to college to become a teacher? And he said, no, I've got a man on campus at 60. But he didn't tell me, he was there for fun. you know. He wasn't getting a degree or anything. So I started college, and I had a little girl in kindergarten, a daughter in elementary, a son in junior high school, a son in high school, and a son on campus with me. And we were the only mother and son on campus. There was mother and daughters in nursing, but we were the only mother and son. And I started in the spring semester, and at that time, you had to take your shots and things that I should have had years before and didn't. And so when I had my TB shot, I had an awful reaction. So even though I'd been in school, see, a half a year already, now I was starting in September, and this happened. So they sent me out to TB hospital to have an x-ray, and while I was standing there, I prayed and told the Lord that it didn't make any difference to me if I was a teacher or if I was going to be at the hospital as a patient. And directly the young man that did the x-ray came back and he said, "Well, you have had TB, but it's healed." And so I became a teacher. And then I was the first one in my class to have a job. There was another girl that had a job at St. Francisville. But when she got, they got a new principal there, and he wouldn't have anybody with associate degree. And so Susie lost her job, and so I was the first one in the class then to have a job out of our class. And I went to a little country school across the bridge, Hutton, you know, on 33. Okay, that was my first year, and like I say, if it hadn't been for my teacher that was over me, you know, to start in student teaching, I wouldn't have known. Things I learned in college didn't help me, really, in teaching my first year. It, you know, I knew to follow your curriculum books and things like that, but things that happen that confront you every day, had she not taught me like she did. And in here it says, some of your questions are, do you remember students? And I always tried to remember my children's first names, not their last names. When you think of Amber Hall, you think about your dad, your grandmothers, your grandfathers, your brothers and your sisters. You bring all of that to you. But if I just think about Amber when you're in the seat in my room, you're a different person. You don't have all that other baggage with you. So if you are a doctor's child or a person on welfare's child, I don't have that to contend with. All I have to contend with is Amber. And I can tell you, so many children from that first day of school till I retired, first names but not their last names. Very few children I know their last names because of that. But that year, the first year of school, I remember little Freddie. And like I say, I don't know his last name, but I've often wondered what kind of home life he had, because some days he'd be a sweet little learner, and the next day he'd come to school and he would stutter till he couldn't hardly read or anything. And I knew every time that happened that something had happened at home that night, you know, that he had to contend with. And I thought, you know what children have to put up with. It's in your room. And then Lolly, I thought of her a while ago. She was the sweetest little blonde-headed girl. And in 1960s, the little girls used to wear their hair part in the middle and little dog ears or ponytails or something on both sides. For some reason, one night, and when Lolly came to school the next day, her mother had taken a knife or a razor blade or scissors or something, and those things was in her, you know, like this out, and she had just took and sliced right down. So you know what Lolly looked like the next day at school. And it just, well, you could either say, feel sorry for her and make her feel bad because she looks so terrible because she was such a pretty child before, or else you can make how pretty she looked, you know. So you have to learn to do things like that. And then I used to think that now the little Stovall girl, I can't remember her first name, and most of the time it's first names. But I don't know if you've been on a farm enough to know what a corn crib is, do you? You know what a corn crib is? You know, it's like you just divide this house halfway into,
okay, yeah,
scoop this half over and that half over there.
Right.
Okay, the little Stovall girl had been out there playing before she came to school that morning, and she had found some baby mice that didn't even have their eyes open, and they were still little pinky mice. She didn't know what to do with them. She had to come and get on the school bus. She took them in and put them in her mother's sugar bowl on the table. And her mother was, you know, her mother was a little society, but I won't, but she told me at school that day what she'd done with the mice and what she'd taken care of. Yet at that same school, I had three children out of one family, you know, like, see, I always, nearly always, taught a first and second combined. And I liked that better than any other situation, because if a second grader hasn't really got a concept you're teaching, when you teach it to your first graders, the second grade hears it again, and it's reinforced. And when you're teaching something to a second grade class, your first grade high accelerated children are even better reinforced, because they have heard that scale taught, and then when it comes time for them to have taught to them, they can just go like whiz bangs through. But I had Tommy the first year. He was in my second grade, because the teacher had retired. He'd been in first grade. He was in my second grade. No, he wasn't. He was in my first grade. The next year, he was in my second grade, and his brother Bruce came to school. Tommy was real smart, but he stayed in his seat and done the things that the teacher said to do. But Bruce was a different child, and he was as smart as Tommy, and it just worried him to death when the kids didn't get their lessons done as soon as he did. So when he'd finish, he'd just get up and go up and down the aisle and help everybody that was having any trouble, or anybody that was a little slower, he helped them with their lessons. So I had, you know, to contend with that, because, well, sometimes it works and sometimes it don't. And this is another thing. Don't ever feel like that you know the only way to teach something. Because sometimes when you're teaching a concept and you know that it's not going over, a child can go to another one or even speak out and tell you, and can tell you a way to teach that or show the children through that thing that you had no idea of. So don't ever feel like, you know, you're the teacher and you're the only one in that room that can say what to do and how to do it at all. Because you'll be surprised that the children can help each other sometimes learn better than what you can help them to learn. You know, you're the teacher, but I mean, there'll be times that you'll find out that that'll happen. But at that same school was when Kennedy was killed. And I remember their teaching, and the principal came down as white as a sheet, and he said, "The president has just been shot." And, of course, we didn't know what was going to happen, you know, whether it was going to be an uprising or whether it was going to be invaded or what, you know, going on. And in times like that, you have to be real careful with your children, because it feeds on each other. You know, if a child is, if you're upset, the children recognizes that right away. And you have to be real careful that you don't bring them into a situation that they can't handle. Now, that was the thing with teaching. I always taught my children that they were number one in the school system. There might have been just only one first grade, or there might have been five first grades. But they were always, had the understanding that they were number one. And I expected them to act that way, and I treated them that way. And I never put them in a situation that they couldn't handle. And one time I remember, this was before all the wonderful aids and helps and things that you've got now, you know, in the 60s, there wasn't hardly anything. And the superintendent brought an old film over, scratched up, junkiest thing I ever saw, but our principal had all of us to go down to the gym to see that film. for some reason, Illinois then was just starting with films, and the superintendent was required to have so many shown in the school systems. And he brought that film about old cars to us and to our school. And you couldn't hardly see it at all. And we were there, and I waited about 10 minutes, and I saw the children. It wasn't going to work. So I just motioned quietly for him to stand up and to be quiet, and we marched out of the gym, even though we were required to be there. But I knew that I was in the right, because my children shouldn't have been put in a situation like that. In first place, the film didn't go with anything we were teaching. It was too high a film for them to understand and appreciate, and the film was so poorly that it shouldn't have been shown in the first place. But and then one time, when I was at Chobonier in Illinois, the cook and the custodian and the janitor and the superintendent were all buddy buddies. Well, I went there. A teacher had been there. Of course, my second grade, another teacher had had the year before. And Dennis missed a lot of school, or started missing a lot of school. And I found out what was wrong, that the cook, I don't remember one day that she had anything but stew. And of course, it was surplus stuff, you see, for the school systems. And she had stew. Well, every child had to eat everything on their plate, or see that reflected back on the cook. She wasn't a good cook. And my little first graders had a dipper full of stuff just the same as fourth and fifth graders did. And if they did not eat that stew, they sat there the whole noon hour, all the time. So I thought out what was wrong, and I just told all my children, I said, you have your mother write me a note that you don't have to eat that, eat whatever they have for dinner. You don't have to. Your mother's paying for the lunch, and you're not required to eat it, so that I had something, you know. And so my children, instead of sitting there during the noon hour, if they didn't eat all their stuff, they went over the trash barrel and dumped it out and went out on the playground to play. And nothing was ever done about it, because I had things, you know, to back me up. But they were always treated with, you have to respect them, I don't care. Whether it's a black child or a green child, they're not that color, they're children. And I've been in school systems where teachers will say, especially if there's more than one first grade, first graders seems like teachers, or second grade teachers, or whatever, kind of clannish, and some of them, they'd say, well, how many black children do you have now? Or if a child was coming into the system, we knew, or how many Mexicans do you have? How many Indians? And I never knew. I never did. And I always tried to give my kids something special. It might be in just two little grains of corn or something at noon when they'd come in, or for some little thing. If they'd been working hard, well, that's, they got a little treat. So that day at noon, they came past my desk, and I think I was giving them two or three grains of corn, candy corn, and Benson put his little hand out, and I thought, my goodness, Benson got his little hands dirty. Benson was a little black boy, and I had forgot that he, you know, that he was black. But I was hard to teach children, not, you know, one kind or the other. And of course, I always taught in inner city, and like I say, college didn't help me very much for teaching the children. Now, in our classes, we were taught, and of course, you know that some of those children would go home, and maybe they had a sack of potato chips or a bottle of pop. And sometimes they went home and they didn't have anything to eat for dinner. That's when I was in Indianapolis. And they didn't have a lunch program at that time. And whether Indianapolis has now or not, I don't know. But they didn't then. And we were taught to give either half an apple or some crackers or something, because children know you can't get your mind on what to learn if your stomach's going around and around and around. But we weren't allowed to give the children one thing to eat, not one thing. And the rule was in the school that everybody had to wear socks of some kind. But they didn't care if the little girls came to school with just little panties and a dress on in the winter. They didn't do anything about it, you know. But they had to have socks on in that school system. And but it as far as the system was, it was a good system because if you were a new teacher went in the building, they were real careful to guide you and let you know what that you needed to do or how to improve or something. And you were done that way for, I suppose, 3 months or so, or maybe longer. But after I was there just a little while, she started to come in my room first, and she came in not to stay to watch me teach, but to get help for the other teachers, you know, aid what she'd say, well, what are you going to do this week, or what are you doing today, or something. Excuse me, and I always shared with her. And I've seen teachers just worried to death when they knew the principal was coming in to observe them or something. But if you're prepared enough to teach your children, if you worked hard enough for that day to instruct them, you oughtn't have any fear of anybody coming into your room. I don't care who it is. But and I've been places where I've told people, you know, and parents, if you can get parents to come to your room, they can be a big help to you, just a big help. They can either sometimes even grade some of your books if you go over them, you know, your little workbooks and things, or they can go over in one corner and read your two or three children, you know. And sometimes just a parent in the room makes a difference in the atmosphere of the room. They're not there. They don't feel like they're there to judge you or to be critical or something. But a mother in the room or a father just does something for the children. I don't know. Maybe it's bringing the home atmosphere in to the school, into your room, you know, or something. I don't know. But I know I've even had board members, you know, they just, I'd say, now you walk in and sit down, and after I do teaching, if you have a question, but don't interrupt me, you know, let me go ahead and teach. It's not a visiting time. You can't have people coming in and talking to you during the time you're teaching because there's too much to do. And then I usually was at school a little after 7, and I was one of the last ones to leave, and even got locked up in school one night because the janitors even had gone home, and I was still there working. But whenever I could, I went to a school system, and I took care of my children at recesses and noon times, and let the other teachers take care of playground duty and theirs. But I took care of mine as much as I could, and most of the time I got to do that. And they knew that there was all kinds of things in the room that they could either play with or that they could study with or do something as long as they were quiet and didn't bother while I was doing board work and other things for them. And even when it rained, the other children all had to go to the gym. And if you've ever been in a gym at noon hour during rainy time with that whole school system, it's bedlam like you never heard before in your life. And my children always got to come back into the room and be in there. And you want to keep your room as attractive as you can. You know, yourself, it's easier for you to read or study or do something in a nice sunny atmosphere than it is in a dark basement center. And I wanted my room to be the prettiest place, the most attractive place. The children would rather be there than at home. And I've had that a lot of times. The children, you know, they wanted to come and they didn't want to leave. It was a different place for them. And that's, you know, I think one thing that helped me was having the children of my own. Because I taught my school children and treated them just like I had treating my children. You know, they knew when mother said something, they could depend on what mother said, whether it was good or whether it was bad. And they learn to respect, you know, and they'll see how far they can go with you, whether it's your own or whether it's the school children. And they want limits put on them they're more secure if they know how far they can go. And I know when I was in Michigan, I've been in some good school systems. And when I was in Michigan, in Kalamazoo, that year in the United States, there were 5 schools chosen, and they were called pacemaker schools, and anything in that system that you could show was a better way of doing things than what the school system was requiring, you were allowed to do it. In fact, they encouraged you to do it. And that year, I was supposed to just have a first grade class, but because second grade classes enrollment was down, they took out the either 7 or 9 second graders that other teachers was having trouble with to put in with my first graders, and they had me to take out of my first graders all the like C or D children, you know, and another teacher. Then they put them in other first grades. And in that second grade class, I had a minister's daughter, Susan, and a little black boy, Clarence, and he didn't want to be black. And he had the prettiest black mother I ever saw. And the only way you could tell Clarence was black was his hair. So I never met his father. He was in Kokomo on the radio. Radio was still going strong then, and he was on radio. But Clarence didn't want to be black. And then I had David was a lawyer's son, and Dorothy was a principal's daughter. And I had then Clarence, and he was from a family, Richard. Richard was from a family where her mother had children, and his dad had children, and they had children. And when, in that second grade, I had 2 Jehovah's Witness girls, too, and I can't remember their names, but they left every day at a certain time to go to study, you know. And I just worked around and had my main lessons, and things was done already when the girls had to leave, you know, so they weren't missing really anything. But little Richard wet his pants every day. So I told Richard, and when things is going on in the room, all the children know it. So they knew, and I told Richard, I said, now, Richard, you sit in your seat just as long as you can, and when you think you can't wait any longer to go to the bathroom, you just get up and go. Whether I'm teaching reading or whether we're in math or whatever we're doing, you just get up and go. And Richard did, and it wasn't 2 weeks till Richard didn't wet his pants anymore. And the children would come in, like I told you, early in the morning, and some of them played and some of them did other things. But Richard loved to write stories. And sometimes in a school system where I went, I had to buy my own writing paper because they have a big sheet, must be about that long and about that high, and there's a place at the top where you can make pictures, and then down at the bottom there's blue, and then there's a red broken line in between the blue lines. And the school system didn't have that. I bought it because that's what I wanted to use. But he'd sit and he'd write page after page after page of stories. You never heard a peep out of him. He just wrote all the time. And so one day I got a letter from his mother, or stepmother, but his mother, and she said, I want you to search Richard every day he comes to school because I think him and his brothers are stopping at the drugstore stealing stuff. And I wrote back and I said, there's no way I'd violate that little boy's rights to search him. No way would I do that. And she wrote a letter to the principal, but anyway, the principal stood behind me and Richard never was searched. Because that's the thing. And then in my first grade class in that same room, I had a doctor's little girl, and Groundhog's Day, we studied about groundhogs. That was, you know, one of our extra things. And she came to school the next morning, and she had torn out a groundhog out of one of her daddy's books. It wasn't a book like you and I would have. I bet that book cost $100 that she tore that page out of and brought to school. Oh, I'm so happy. You know, they do things. and you don't know what to do about it. And, you know, the page was like, it wasn't plastic or something over, but the page was real thick. It must have been as thick as 3 or 4 leaves of a regular book. But she brought the groundhog out of the book to school. She wanted to do that. But anyway, okay, alrighty. Ready to go again. It said on here, when and where did you teach? And I started in 1963 over, as I told you, at Hutton. And then in the years past, I went from Hutton to Kalamazoo, Michigan, and from Kalamazoo, Michigan down to Indianapolis. From Indianapolis to Birds, Illinois, from Birds, Illinois to Vandalia, Illinois, or Chauvenier, and from there up to Geneseo, and there I had the best principal I ever had in my life, and I can't remember his name. I can remember my Indianapolis principal because he was new to the system, Mr. Lutz, and he told me one day going up steps that he wasn't going to evaluate me as high as I ought to be because the people downtown would think he didn't know his business. And I laughed at him, and I told him I didn't need his evaluation. So smart, Eliki-like. And then when I went to Iowa, I needed his evaluation. And it wasn't good. Probably because I smarted off to it.
Probably needed it.
But I told him, I said, you know, I knew my business. Only one time in my whole teaching experience was I ever rejected it from a job. And the other places, I was hard on the spot. And when I was at Geneseo or Vandalia, Geneseo, while I was there and the principal there, that's when they wrote all kind of things about the Davenport school system, Lincoln, the school system, Lincoln. And of course, there's a lot of schools in Davenport. And I thought, no school could be that way, that bad. Or the teachers, there had to be, you know, it just couldn't be. It was parents writing letters to the editor, and it was just an awful, awful mess. So I talked to the principal, and I wrote to Davenport, and I said, now, if you can put me in the Lincoln school system, I want to be a teacher here. And otherwise, I don't want a thing to do with your school system. I was happy where I was at. And, of course, they put me in Lincoln gladly. And you would not believe the things that went on in the supposed to be a teaching situation. In the mornings after breakfast, they had school lunches at that time, and after breakfast, the custodians came in with shovels and scooped stuff up off the floor that the children had just dropped and walked in and spilled, and it was a mess. And the principal, as long as things seemed like was going all right and a mother or a parent wasn't there complaining, on the surface things was fine. So if you had a problem in your room and started to go to him for help, if he saw you, he went someplace else as fast as he could go. You didn't have any help at all with Mr. Smith. And you had no discipline. In Illinois, when I taught in Illinois, you paddled, and you didn't have to have any permission, or you didn't have to have anybody with you or anything. That was one of the things you did. And now, I don't believe in paddling like somebody, but sometimes you can pick a child up and give him a smack on his bottom end, and it sets him down and everybody else in the room. But those times are far in between. But in Iowa, you couldn't do that. And you had no, if you don't have any help from your higher ups, you know, the children soon learn that. They know how far they can go and what they can do and all. So I was just there the first year and then asked for a transfer. And you know, when you go into a system, you don't ask for a transfer the first year and expect to get it, but I did. But while I was at that system, my first graders tested 12th grade level, part of them. And the principal wouldn't believe me, I believe, the test, and he did the test over. And some of them, I think, even did higher than Bart. But the thing was, when I taught, the first thing we did in the morning, of course, was after we got all settled down and everything, I taught writing. Now, I don't know if they teach writing in, as a subject in school now or not, but we did then. And while I was teaching writing, I was also teaching phonics, and any skill that we'd had, was going to have that day, or we'd had the day before, like a blend of TH or a vowel sound or something. Whenever I had a word on the board that contained those things, I stopped and they gave me words or gave me the sound or something like that. So I correlated reading, the skills of reading and writing, and then I had the art lesson to go in them together. Because on those big sheets, like I told you, I used for writing, after we were done with the writing lesson, part of the group drew a picture to illustrate the writing lesson we'd had that day. While they were doing that, I had the other reading group back at the back teaching the skills and the things of the reading. And then it was about recess time by that time, after I'd had the two reading classes. And the first reading class that had gone back to their seats to do their picture, and then the others came back to me. And then we would have recess, and then when we came back in, we reinforced the reading class. Really, my social studies was correlated even in with the others, because I felt like as long as I taught the children to read and to do math and to do writing, they could cope with anything that they had to contend with. So then, the first thing after noon then, I always had math. As soon as we went in, we had, that was our lesson. And then after math was done and the seat work was done, then we had reading again for the day. And then the second graders had to have spelling brought into that thing. And every day I tried to have something extra. I don't know, something that they wasn't expecting, or something other teachers wasn't doing, or something, to always to let my children know that they were choice kids, they were special. And in November then, the last day of November, when we would go home for the holidays and we'd come back and start the first day of December, every day after lessons was all done, we did something to put on our Christmas tree. And we did that till Christmas time, or else we did something murals in the hallway or on our room inside. And the children from other rooms would come in and just walk around to look at things, to see things, you know, because nothing like that was going on in the other rooms. And then when I was in school systems, I think music and art is the icing on stuff. And hardly ever I went into a school system and had art. So I took my free time sometimes the principal would take my children out for exercises or something, and I would teach art in the other rooms in the system I was in, and to make sure that they had something. And then one year, I don't know whether I was in a class or how it came about, but anyway, I asked my principal if I could use music in the room. And he consented, and, you know, it was going to be watched or something. And anyway, I had music going real softly in the room, and you could hear once in a while a child real softly singing with that song or something. And it was always low enough that it didn't bother if I was teaching a class or something, you know, it didn't bother that. And that worked. Because to hear the music, the children had to be quiet. You know, that was one way they to take care of that. But as far as a classroom, I remember best. To me, they were all best. You know, I wouldn't have been a teacher had not God healed me. You see, I wouldn't have ever been. And when we had to take that Illinois test over again, and like I say, everybody failed it, but the little secretary in the superintendent's office. But anyway, we had to take that over, and I prayed and asked God to give me just exactly a certain number, and I got that number on my test so that I'd always remember that I was a teacher because, you know, that's what I was supposed to do. I took that with me into the room, but that, you know, knowing that that was there, and here it says about the administrators and all of them except Mr. Lutz, and that wasn't nice of me. And I did have a principal one time, Elwood Hutton. He had been over at a prison thing for teenagers, you know, something like that. And one day he would be real strict. The kids couldn't do anything. See, in the country schools, there was a principal over the whole system, but he had to teach like 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. And then another teacher taught 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and then I had 1st and 2nd. And then the next day then, he just let the kids do anything. You know, they could just do anything they wanted to. So I finally just closed my books and said my kids wasn't gonna contend with it. And so you always have a school board, that's one good thing. But anyway, things got worked out, but even though there is somebody higher, there's always somebody higher than that person, you know. Most of the time, of course, when I was at Chauvinier, there wasn't, because they were all Fish and Buddy friends, and nothing could be done about it. You have to respect your administrator in your system, but sometimes you have some quirks, I guess. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe me. But as far as the students, there's lots of them I remember. And then the courses in the teaching the art class, for the curriculum, I wrote a book of how you take one art lesson and change it just a little bit to do for 2nd grade, then change it a little bit more, add 2 and do 4, up to the 6th grade. And I was married at that time, and my husband wanted me to take it and have it published. And instead of that, I just took it down to the office, mimeographed it off, and gave it to every one of the teachers in our building. I just wasn't in for writing books, but I was in for helping other teachers. So that's what I did with it. And when I first started teaching, my salary was $3,000-something. I can't remember the exact, it seemed like $3,600. And when the next year, if I would retired at Christmas time, and the next year it would have been $21,000. But I had my master's from 15 hours above, and went to school every summer and night classes, you know, because I taught with teachers that hadn't done anything else to their education from the time they had got their degree 40 years ago, you know, nothing, and they were trying to teach new math like they were taught when they were a little girl or boy, and the children, you know, the books taught one way and the teacher taught another, so it was a funny thing, funny situation, but trying situations of my career, I guess, Mr. Lutz. Poor guy. Poor guy. No, I don't know. But when did you feel successful? And I felt successful right away because I made sure every day I was prepared. And that's what you have to do. You can't be successful. I was in a system once where a teacher, forget her last name, first name was Beth, and when she came to school in the morning at 8 o'clock, it was like a factory. She went to work at 8 o'clock. At 4 o'clock, factory was over. She didn't do anything else about school. And if you're going to teach like that, you're in the wrong profession, because 8 hours a day is not long enough to prepare to teach 25 or 30 children. And I took work home with me at night, and I went back to school sometimes on Sunday. And I was in school systems where I had to do, not had to do, they asked me to do the halls and things, and like I say, I wanted everything to be as attractive as we could get it, and the older children appreciated so being able to get to do art and stuff. And after school, one of the schools I was in, the teachers volunteered to teach classes. And I had, of course, the art taught art to some of the kids, and we had a real doozy of a young kid. He must have been in the sixth grade, and he wore a leather jacket and strutted around with boots on, you know, thought he was somebody. And when he came into my room, the coat came off, and his attitude was different. But as long as he's had that coat on, you know, like that. And I wasn't teaching when they were wearing hats, but I wouldn't have allowed that in my room. Nobody would have wore a hat in the room, because if you go to an office, you have to dress a certain way. And if you're in business any place, or the work system, most places, you have a not a dress code as such, but yet there's some regulation that goes on. And but anyway, that young man, he was different when he took his coat off at the door, hung it on the back of the chair. He was a different child, but he was something else before that. But anyway, I guess that's about all I got to tell you. I don't know.
Gosh, you covered all the questions, the extra questions I had.
Well, anyway, I enjoyed it. But at the last, when I was in Iowa, of course, the snow is so bad there. And at Christmas time, when I got ready to, I was divorced. And I thought, well, I was called Social Security, and I checked in all my different things that I could draw money from. And I could be wrong, but I believe I would have only drawn $50 more a month teaching school every day than retiring and going to Arizona and having fun. So that's what I did. And the last January, when I went out to get my last check, the snow, one of the main roads out of town that I had to go on, was part of the time was one way, and you know, you could just go piecing and go over and that way, and the snow was higher than my car. So that, and then when I was at Kalamazoo, Michigan, we had a big snowstorm while I was there, and in 68, and that's, I had gone to the doctor, this is not on teaching, but I'd gone to the doctor, and my test hadn't come back good, and my kids from Vincennes came and brought my daughter up to Michigan to be with my younger daughter while I went to the hospital. And it took them nine hours to go like 10 miles or something. And the people in our park then had big equipment, and they were going out and find them, and they came in then, home then. But the little kids then up there, they went out in the street, but now if you had a tornado drill or something, you didn't leave any child go home unless you knew that parent was there or something, you know. Nobody was allowed to go because it was in the tornado thing, alley there. But while I tell you this, I happen to think where I retired from, I had a little boy from one of the islands. Where was the last war we had over there? The men got so depressed over Korea. Somebody had adopted him, and he was staying with some other people. Well, Jehovah Witness, you know, can't give a gift, you know, like Christmas time, and they can't honor anybody or anything like that. Okay, this little boy was in my room, and when the children had birthday parties or something, see, he couldn't even take of that. You can't take like that. But if I had knew ahead of time and could slip out a cookie or something out of what the child was going to give for their birthday treat in the class, or if I had known ahead of time and could take something to have in my desk, I could give him something, and they could stay in, you know, and participate in the party. But the other teachers would just send their children to the office, and that child had to sit in the office knowing that a party was going on down the hall. And they couldn't participate because they were Jehovah's Witness. But anyway, that little boy then, I didn't tell my children that I wouldn't be back when they came back to school, that I wouldn't be there. But somehow, I don't know whether I told some of the mothers or not, but anyway, this little boy found out about that night after he'd gone home. And he had to sleep with his big brother because he cried all the time that I was not going to be there when he went back to school. So the next day when school was out, his mother, adopted mother, brought him to school and had me a necklace with a little ear corn on. See, that was Iowa, a little ear corn on. So see, and then I left it in Arizona when I moved. I left it on the table, my little ear corn on there. But sometimes teachers can be so cruel to children. It's not the child's, they seem to think that it's the child's fault because they're Jehovah's Witness or something, you know. And they make no allowance, and it's not only just Jehovah's Witness, it'd be other people too, you know. If it's easier just to get them out of the room and get them out of the way and not contend with things than it is to try to work around to make that child not feel like that he's dirt, so to speak. Because, you know, when a party's going on and a first or second grader, they don't always understand why they came, you know. And yet it's the belief of the parents, but yet the children, see, are just not, most of them are not big enough to understand what's going on. But and then another thing I wanted to tell you, play as many games as you can that pertains to your lesson. As we would go down to our lunch thing, we would count, and my children knew the multiplication tables, first and second graders. They could add and subtract two-digit numbers, and I don't know whether I would now or not because I have a feeling about playing bingo, but we played a lot of bingo for that extra time in the room that when we lessons was over, and I'd say, well, under the B, two tens and one. Or under the whatever I, you know, something else. So see, we were learning math, and they didn't realize they were learning math. It was a game to them. Same way it was when we were walking down the, you know, down the hall or something. And then when I was in Iowa, we lived real close to the park. So I would take a apple box, and we'd put the milk cartons in there. And then we had a double line, and two children would carry the box, and we would count so far, and that those two children put the box down, two other children move forward and tuck the box, and we carried the milk cartons over to the park to play. And then when I was at Vandalia, we lived right by, our school was right by the park. So instead of having my recess when other teachers was having their recess, I had recess the last thing of the day because they're tired the last thing of the day. And we would take our 15 minutes and go on the swings and the slide, waiting on the buses to come. So, and some of the fourth graders didn't think that was right at all, you know, that they were out there playing. And they were in the schoolroom doing hard work. But it just, I don't know. But anyway. Oh, and then when I was at Davenport, also in my first year at Jefferson, I had a little black girl, and she saw her father. They were the kind of black people that you read about in terrible magazines and things. There's a difference in black people. They tell me, I don't know, but they say from Mississippi they're one kind, and when from another place area they're a different kind of people. But anyway, there was a lot of terrible stuff went on in that home, and she saw her father killed, you know, in a fight right in the home. Mm-hmm. And Cindy, I saw her one day take a little oak chair like the little first grader sit in, throw it across the room and broke it all to pieces. And she would just get violent. And now with her, I never could succeed. And sometimes I'd have to send for the principal and Jill would come down, or else I'd take her down to the office. Because you never knew what she's going to do. She got so violent. A first grader, I couldn't have handled her as big as I was. No way. But then another first grade teacher in that building, his mother, was one of these people, like 900, the fortune tellers or whatever you call them. Yeah, she was that way. So she said she would take her in her room and she'd talk to her mother-in-law about it, and she did. And they found out a whole lot of things that, you know, they did different than what I did, but I don't think Cindy ever, you know, really, they ever really done anything to Cindy. But you don't know what all she had to contend with in her life, you know, at home, her home environment. And I look at these children on television from Africa and places like that. You can't hardly look at them, you know, but what they have gone through with, and some of the children that you'll have in your room, unless you're in a high place, you know, standing in a high economic place, you'll have children that no way can you ever visualize what that child goes home to and what that child has to contend with in the time he's gone from your room till he gets back. And you don't know why sometimes that child can't learn, but when you bring all that baggage together, then you, there's no room in his mind to learn. There's, it's like he shuts off, you know, so that he can't be hurt anymore in his other place. And another thing, children will have a vocabulary at home, they'll have a vocabulary in the school playground, and they'll have a vocabulary in your room, you know. So it's just one of those things. I don't know, but I'm so glad that I got to teach it. I was unhappy, or I feel bad about it. My mother died before I became a teacher, and when she was about 17 or 18, I guess, she was still going to country school, and she rode a mule 5 miles to go to school. So I always felt like that was instilled in me, you know, the value of an education. And from her, because and she could do so many things, so many things I know how to do, I learned from mother, and she was just a teacher without it. But she rode 5 miles. I wouldn't have even went a half a mile, especially on a mule. Well, you can push a button.
I probably wouldn't either.